Welcome to the Community Safety Podcast with Jim Nixon, alongside St Ives Chambers, RHE Global and Barden Co-Recruitment in partnership with District 4. This podcast will explore how we can transform our communities in the 21st century.
I'd like to think that we do it because it's the right thing to do. But you and I worked in policing at a time when police chief would often stand up and say, sorry, under investigation, we'll get back to you. Oh, people don't want to hear that.
It's now time. This is the Community Safety Podcast. Community Safety Podcast with Jim Nixon.
We are finally back and raring to go. Guys, I'm apologise for the gap with the Community Safety Podcast. Work has been hectic. There's been a lot going on, but we are back bigger and stronger. Today's podcast will look at policing and the importance of good quality leadership. Today's guest is Kathleen O'Toole, ex-chief of Boston and Seattle Police Departments, and also the first chief inspector of Garda Inspectorate in Ireland. So a really good view of both sides of the pond. Thank you so much for agreeing to come on.
Oh, thank you for the invitation, Jim. I really appreciate it.
Given the career that you've had in policing, you weren't actually too keen to join the police in the first instance, were you?
No, it wasn't ever an ambition of mine. In fact, as a youngster growing up, there were so few women in policing here. It wasn't until the early 1970s that the Boston Police Department hired the first women. And by the time I started in the business in 1979, there were still only a few dozen women in the organization. And I went along with a friend who wanted to be a police officer in the worst way, took the exam just for kicks. And when I was offered the job, my law school friends dared me to do it. And here I am decades later. So I wish I could say there was something strategic about my career, but I took the job on a dare.
What was it like in the U.S. policing back then?
Well, it was very different. I mean, policing in general was very different. I was incredibly fortunate to have some wonderful mentors and friends who supported me along the way. You know, I've heard other women tell horror stories about their experiences early on the job, but mine were generally very positive, very favorable. You know, like I say, I had some great mentors. I was quite young when Bill Bratton, for instance, who eventually became the commissioner in New York City, and he was also the chief out in L.A. for a while. You know, Bill's an icon in policing, but he was one of my mentors who really brought me along. So, yeah, I was very fortunate. But, you know, it was so different. I mean, words like prevention and intervention didn't even cross our lips. It was all about going out and fighting crime and racing from call to call. And it was exciting. It was exhilarating. But I think we came to realize pretty early on that as hard as we were working, we were failing. Quality of life in our city kept on deteriorating and crime kept climbing. And it was probably in the late 80s, early 90s that we determined we needed to do a different way.
I joined later in the sort of mid-90s, but it was exactly the same. You know, I was assigned to response, and it was literally, how many people can you arrest? How many jobs can you get rid of quickly? How many stop and search have you done? And that was effectively it. And you weren't measured in any other way. And, you know, if I'm being honest with you, I'm really disappointed the way domestic abuse and things like that were dealt with back then. It was embarrassing, really, the way that we dealt with things. And the way that we just had no foresight to look at the bigger problem. And I think the other point that you raised was just how important, when you are a young police officer, how important those mentors are. I've seen horror stories where officers just had the wrong people that were guiding them and incorrectly guiding them, and they kind of didn't last 5 minutes. And I was lucky, like you, that I had some great mentors.
I feel that it's been, in recent years, my most important role and the one that I get the greatest satisfaction out of, in bringing the next generation forward. You know, it's very, very rewarding. But it's, again, you're right. Unless you have the right mentor, it's easy to go down the wrong path. It appears that both of us were blessed to have good people.
What do you think attracted you to stay, you know, for the years that you did? You know, what was the turning point for you after you kind of initially joined?
I actually completed law school and had the opportunity to go out and practice law full time, but I'd already been in policing for a year or two and realized I'd found my true vocation. And as I say, it was exhilarating making all those felony arrests. And I had the opportunity to do some fairly interesting assignments. For instance, I was a decoy officer on the subway, so my job was to get robbed every day. And so I had some exciting, you know, law enforcement experiences, but it wasn't long before I realized that that's only a fraction of the work that police do. In fact, a recent study here in the U.S. showed that even in major cities, only about 4% of police work is about violent crime, and less than 15% law enforcement, any form of law enforcement. And the vast majority of police work is providing assistance to vulnerable people. And while the arrests were exhilarating, I can't think of anything that was more personally rewarding than saving a couple lives and delivering a couple babies and just being there for people who are vulnerable. And I think that we do a terrible job of telling that story. You know, I don't know if you're doing a better job of that in the UK, but we're really struggling to recruit police officers here. And I think that a lot of candidates think it's just all about the stuff they watch on television. It's all about car chases and the gunfights, and when that's just a fraction, a small fraction of police work.
Exactly the same in the UK. I actually met an awful lot of police officers that had actually joined, and they loved the blue light run. But I did find that there were, you know, you're right, you know, they watch the cop shows on TV. You know what it's like. We went out with friends at the weekend, and I was talking to the guy I was with, and he's still in the police as a serving officer, you know. And I was talking to him about, you know, when you don't come home. My wife and kids didn't see me for a whole week. So I do think it is important that we do sell the reality.
Yeah, I think not only do we need to sell it to recruits, Jim, but we need to sell it to elected officials and you know, other government officials as well. When I went out to Seattle, for instance, our biggest challenge there was at the intersection of public health and public safety. You know, it was a relatively safe town compared to most major cities. And we had huge challenges with homelessness and addiction conditions and people in mental health crisis. In fact, they weren't even capturing that data when I first arrived out there. And I said, look, we need to get a better sense for what our officers are actually doing so we can deploy them more effectively. And after a year of collecting more comprehensive data, we determined that our officers were responding to people in serious mental health crisis about 10,000 times a year. Well, that was far more times than they were responding to gunfights and violent crimes. So I think it really gave us the opportunity to tell our story more effectively. And then, of course, some people said, well, okay, take that work away from the police then. You know, that was the first reaction, you know, defund the police and put the money elsewhere. But we had additional data to show that half of those people, 50%, were threatening, you know, themselves or others, and nearly 10% of them were armed. So I think it just underscores that we need to be very thoughtful about community safety strategies that we deploy. And I'm a big fan of multidisciplinary approaches, you know, harnessing resources across different sectors in order to provide a better solution for our communities.
Oh, it's so true. I mean, I spent an awful lot of my career in community policing, neighborhood policing, and without your key partners, you're doing it with one hand behind your back. And I realized that very early on my career, how important our housing colleagues were, our mental health teams, our local authorities. You know, I've been lucky and privileged to have been in some of those situations in my policing career. I'm like you, I'm a big, big advocate of it, because you can get it really right if you can get those right people around the table, I think.
That's so true. I often cite three very different examples, but back in the late 1990s in Massachusetts, we started using multidisciplinary approaches. Boston is the best example. The Boston Police Department at the time went from, I think had 154 homicides, an all-time high for the city 1 year. And then just a few years later, you know, less than probably 5-6 years later, they were all the way down to 31. Still 31 too many, but most of them had been gang violence, you know, young gang members taking each other's lives. But we actually got clergy involved. We had social workers. We had youth violence, you know, prevention workers, we had police, we had probation, parole, we had everybody harnessing resources to try to put our arms around these kids, not only to save their lives, but to get them the services they needed to be successful. And whether it was education programs or jobs programs. So that was one example. We also, you mentioned domestic violence earlier. We had established in Massachusetts a governor's council on domestic violence. And again, all of the different players came to the table, the health professionals, the police, judges. You know, we had a real comprehensive approach to domestic violence. And I believe that made a huge difference as well. And then finally, when I was out in Seattle, we established a navigation team to assist the homeless there. And we were able to work again with homeless advocates, with mental health professionals, with counselors in order to, you know, try to provide a better path for people. And in all of those instances, I think we produced the best results because it wasn't simply the police. You know, we accessed other important resources too. It can be hard work. It can be hard work to get all these different groups together and to overcome some of the bureaucratic challenges. But at the end of the day, I think it's really worth it. Certainly beneficial to our communities.
You're absolutely right. You know, and it is sometimes hard. And there's been times when I've had to go, you know, higher, you know, to a higher sort of rank or a higher senior management level because I'm not getting where I want to be because people aren't taking responsibility. But what I have found is now if you identify the key people that you need around the table and you hold them accountable, you can do some really terrific work. And I think ultimately for me, Kathleen, and I think from what I've read about yourself and the way that you've approached policing, we're dealing with real people here. And at the end of the day, I didn't meet that many really bad people, but I met an awful lot of broken ones. You know, there are people that do need to be in prison to protect the majority of the public. But I do think there are people that we can work with. And that sort of partnership approach to me is key to that, really, to get people back on the straight and narrow.
I totally agree. And I have a particular passion for young people in underserved neighborhoods. They're trying to give them the support, the educational opportunities, the job opportunities, the supports that they need in order to succeed. And I've seen so many young people overcome incredible challenges. And live, you know, very productive and successful lives as a result. So I'm all for that.
I've done exactly the same. You know, I had a number of kids when I was a sergeant and I was working with a number of kids in our neighbourhood. And, you know, a lot of people had written them off, really. You know, they'll just get locked up. And me as an officer and my team just showing a bit of faith in some of these young kids, you know, treating them like proper human beings and actually making them feel valued. And we got some, like you, amazing results. And I know there were a number of those kids that, had we not intervened when we did, they probably would have ended up going down the wrong path. But by our early intervention, there was a good proportion that we actually did save. And I get immense pleasure from that.
Absolutely. You know, you touched on something else that I don't want to forget too, and that is your role there out on the front lines as a police officer and as a sergeant. If I could go back to the Alpha 19 car in downtown Boston tonight and answer 911 calls for service, I would do it in a heartbeat. You know, I mean, I had these great mentors who coached me along and encouraged me to go up through the ranks, but without a doubt, that was still my favorite job. And those are the people that I have the greatest respect for. And I think as we develop strategies, we need to hear those voices. We need to hear the voices of the people, you know, on the front lines. When I went to Seattle, I recall the media on the first day saying, "What's your community policing strategy?" And I said, "Well, I'm not going to dictate that from the top down, from the chief's office. You know, I want to hear from the people living and working in our neighborhoods, including the police officers who are out on the front lines." And we developed a unique community policing micro plan for each neighborhood in the city. And those plans were developed primarily by officers on the beat and those they serve. So I think it was a great program. But, you know, I want to make sure that we express our appreciation to those who are out there on the front lines every day, because they're my true heroes.
I couldn't agree more. I love being a sergeant, you know, having that kind of team around me and being responsible for a particular neighborhood and, you know, everything that goes on in that neighborhood. I had probably one of the hardest communities in the area I was actually working in at the time. And everybody kind of says, oh, you'll never succeed there. You know, you're wasting your time, et cetera, et cetera. And for me, that's like a red rag to a bull, you know. At the end of the day, I'm thinking, you know what, I'm going to prove you guys wrong. And we reduced crime massively. We reduced, you know, antisocial behavior, as you probably would call it in the States. And we transformed that community by working with the right people. And again, you know, that was the best time of my policing career, having the ability to change lives for the better. But picking up on one of your points, one of the things that I think I would be critical sometimes of the UK policing model, particularly around community and neighbourhood policing, is that sometimes we did feel that we were sort of dictated to from above, and that we didn't probably always develop those plans and get the buy-in from senior management. It always seemed to be just across the board, and sometimes we weren't actually consulted. And I think actually, as a neighbourhood sergeant myself, I probably developed that myself and delivered it myself, and was quite innovative in that way, because I wasn't getting that sort of upwards kind of buy-in, you know, about every neighbourhood is unique. And I think you've just hit the nail on the head for me, that every neighbourhood is different, and you've got to speak to the people on the ground. You know, you hit the nail on the head for me, that every neighbourhood is different, and you've got to speak to the people on the ground.
Yeah, absolutely. When we developed these plans in Seattle, we actually had the assistance of Seattle University too, because I think it's important to bring, you know, kind of academic rigor to these projects as well, so that we can create the right metrics, so we can measure our results, we can refine the programs accordingly. So Seattle University was a wonderful partner, and they assigned interns. Many of the interns eventually came to work for our police department, but they were graduate students and seniors, and they assisted us in each one of these neighborhoods and helped facilitate the development of these plans and also the creation of the metrics. It was an incredible experience. We said, look, we're always going to answer 911 calls. We're always going to be there to answer the emergency calls. But if we're not answering an emergency call, what are the 3 to 5 priorities the people in that neighborhood want us to address? And often it was a quality of life issue. You know, it may not be something that the police had the direct ability to address, but the police could certainly help leverage additional resources to assist that community. And we had a famous American politician, Tip O'Neill, who always said, all politics is local. Well, all policing is local too, right? I mean, not only does each jurisdiction have its unique characteristics, but each neighborhood in each jurisdiction has unique characteristics. And while the general principles of democratic policing are the same and should be applied across the board, you know, it's important to take into consideration the unique characteristics of each neighborhood.
One question I wanted to ask you was about women in policing. You've obviously broken some significant barriers in your career. Can you share your experiences in navigating, you know, that often male-dominated kind of world of policing, and how we can sort of encourage more diversity and inclusion in enforcement?
Well, I think the first thing we need to do is to tell the real story of policing. We do a horrible job of telling our own story. And I think if people knew exactly what police do, if they got a glimpse of it, they'd be much more likely to pursue careers in policing. Actually, you've done a much better job on your side of the Atlantic of recruiting women into the business. We're still at about 12% here in the U.S. Policing, and I understand that you're well over 30% in the U.K. I know Ireland's done remarkably well in recent years, too, as has even the PSNI in Northern Ireland. You know, traditionally was a much more male-dominated organization, but in recent years, they have been able to recruit lots more women. So I often say that we have to look to your side of the Atlantic for better examples. But I do think that we need to tell our own story. I also think it's great to get people into the organization. I just mentioned the Seattle University project, for instance. Several of the graduate students that came to assist us were women. And most of them were offered jobs in the police department after their their university careers ended, and some became non-sworn members of our organization. There were data analysts and researchers. Others decided to pursue careers in sworn policing in the sworn ranks. So I think the more opportunities we provide to a diverse candidate pool to come in, experience it firsthand, I think we're more likely to attract a larger candidate pool. I also am a huge advocate for programs like the cadet programs, or we call the exploring programs here in the U.S. Boy Scouts of America has a program called Learning for Life, and one of the programs under that is Police Exploring, a program that's available for young people between the ages of, I think it's 14 and 21. It's an unpaid role, but it's an opportunity to work with the police. They do a lot of work on community events. They learn about policing. They do ride-alongs with the police. You know, in Seattle, it was wonderful. We'd go out to community events, and the explorers in many neighborhoods were our bridge to the community because we had a really diverse pool of explorers. I'd say the majority of those young people decided to pursue careers in policing because they had the opportunity to come in and see it firsthand. In the Boston Police Department, we had a cadet program, and that was for young people who are a bit older. I think the minimum age was 18. It was 18 to 25, something in that range. And again, they were able to come in, spend some time working in a non-sworn role. I mean, they wore uniforms and all. Sometimes in the holiday season, they'd go out and direct traffic, but they were always at community events. They'd work inside the station side by side with the police. And they really had the opportunity to get to understand the organization, get to understand the role of police. So I think that, you know, whether we're trying to recruit women or, again, a wide range of diverse candidates, the more we can expose them to policing firsthand, I think the greater candidate pool will get. Another thing, Jim, that you've done a much better job at is recruiting non-sworn members to your organizations.
Yeah.
And we still have very small percentages of non-sworn people in our organizations. And, you know, I've found that we're often able to recruit a much more diverse candidate pool into non-sworn positions. You know, I think there are some police services in the UK that are around 50%, correct? Yeah. And, you know, ours would be less than half of that. So, I think another Seattle example, when I went out to Seattle, the command staff at the time was comprised of all people who looked like me in terms of, you know, race and ethnicity and all. There was only one other woman that remained on my command staff from the group that I encountered when I first went out there. And they were all wonderful people that had worked hard for years in policing, but they were all like-minded. And by the time I left, half of my command team were people that were not sworn police officers, that brought different professional experiences, lived experiences, educational experiences. And we were diverse in every respect, not only in terms of race and gender, but, you know, in terms of all those other factors. You know, by the time I left, I think among us, we had 4 JDs, 4 PhDs, a former aeronautics engineer, and some incredibly committed career police officers. And we really complemented each other. You know, we felt this collective purpose. You know, it was just an incredible experience. But those people who hadn't spent their lives in policing, in sworn policing, brought very different perspectives to the table. And I loved it when they would, you know, very objectively question, you know, some of our ideas or some of our strategies, and they just brought new perspectives to the table that were invaluable. So I think that's another way to recruit people into non-sworn positions. And then, of course, some of them decide that they want to, you know, move in the direction of sworn officer careers as well. So, but I think that diversity is so important, and that the police service, wherever we are in the world, in order to be successful, in order to be credible or legitimate, has to reflect the community it serves.
I think you're right. I've got no problem with people that are not sworn coming in, and I think they have a real role to play. There was a couple of drives where people were coming in from industry and they were like given the inspector rank and they were like, you know, no policing experience. And I think the rank and file officers found that quite difficult because their argument was, well, you've never done it as a PC.
Yeah, I remember that program when that was introduced in the UK. And, you know, I had some questions about it myself. But I'm not in a position to assess it at this point because I didn't follow it. But, you know, here I wasn't suggesting that people would come in at leadership ranks and then assume sworn policing roles. I feel that if many of us come up through the ranks as good coppers and good detectives, but have little exposure to management and leadership experience. And I think that has to be acquired over time, but and we can bring people into roles. I know in both Boston and Seattle, I converted sworn police roles, like superintendent of administration, which was a very significant role in the Boston Police Department. And in Seattle, there was an assistant chief who was responsible for all the administrative functions for budget, finance, IT, education and training. Why do we need sworn police people in those positions? Why not get people who are better suited and have more experience? I mean, we're running these massive organizations in many instances with thousands or tens of thousands of personnel and millions, hundreds of millions, if not billions in operating money. Why not have people who have business acumen? You know, why not bring them in to assist us? So I think that's really important to look at all the roles in the police department and to determine which ones should be held by sworn members who have paid their dues and risen through the ranks and worked out on the front lines, who understand policing because they've lived it firsthand, but also those who bring different skill sets, different value to the organization, and also, you know, bring that objective perspective that can be helpful. I love having people that challenge me, which brings me to another point you made, and that is about leadership. You know, traditionally in this country, in the U.S., you know, we've built policing on a rank structure, more like a paramilitary model for policing, and it's been very autocratic. And I think those days are over, too. I think that we need to have a more democratic form of leadership and management and policing. I know even if I only have 5 minutes to make an important decision, I try to get as many people in the room as possible and canvas their opinions because it's just so much more valuable. In policing, sometimes we do have to make split second decisions, and I can be an autocrat in those instances, you know, when it's life or death or you have to make a split second decision, you know, but that's very occasionally. It's not, that doesn't happen often. And, you know, I think for the most part, we need to democratize our policing services so that more people throughout the ranks have a voice in the process.
I've seen this so many times where just because you're a good cop on the ground and you pass a couple of exams, and I think the best leaders that I've worked under in the police service are exactly like you're saying there. When key decisions need to be made, they bring more people into the room and they don't make those split decisions. And I think then as a person being led by somebody, to be able to actually feel you've contributed to that decision makes you feel valued, and you're going to run through brick walls for those people. I like to surround myself with people that are better than me, because I think if you can do that and you can leave your ego at the door and understand that people are better than you just because you're a person of rank and the top of the tree as the chief, that says it all really for me. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that is just such a great approach.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think in some of the largest change projects I've had to oversee, I've always established a group of individuals either to kind of help implement that change. And that when we go into a room and we have spirited discussions, I always say, look, I'm leaving my rank at the door. I expect all of you will too. And, you know, we're going to have respectful, but you know, sometimes spirited discussions. And I think the best results evolve from that type of scenario.
Your policing career in some ways is quite unique in that you've obviously, you know, been high ranking in the States, both in Boston and in Seattle. But also you had the experience of obviously coming over to Southern Ireland and working with the Garda and the Inspectorate. Firstly, how that came about. Also, what sort of experiences that allowed you to then take back? Did you learn anything from that experience?
Well, actually, my first introduction to the island of Ireland was working on the Patent Commission during the peace process in the north. So the transformation of the RUC to the PSNI was my first introduction to policing on that island, which is entirely different, of course, than policing in the Republic of Ireland. Chris Patton, who's just such a wonderful human being and such a principled man, he said, look, this is a very contentious subject. We're never going to keep everybody happy, but at the end of the day, we're going to listen to all perspectives and we'll go where the truth takes us. And I just never forgot. I think that's such a powerful message. It's a simple message, but a powerful message. We crisscrossed Northern Ireland. We visited nearly every police station there, talked to police officers on the beat, you know, did ride-alongs with police officers, but also met with community members in working-class neighborhoods and middle-class neighborhoods, and, you know, loyalists, Republican, you know, unionists, nationalists. I mean, we heard everybody's perspectives. And I think that was incredibly valuable. And at the end of the day, we had so many people come back to us, people representing very, very different perspectives there, and said to us, look, you know, we really appreciate the fact that you listened. You know, we may not agree with everything. We may not agree with all your recommendations, but at the end of the day, we really appreciate that we had a voice in the process. And that was an incredible lesson for me that I carried forward, listening carefully to people's perspectives. And when I went to the Republic of Ireland, it was a new structure that had been created, somewhat similar to HMIC. So they decided to create this inspectorate in Ireland, and it was on the heels of a scandal there and determination to reform policing in Ireland. And so I was asked to assume the role, which I did, and stayed there for 6 years. And it was an incredible experience. And again, I certainly learned as much from it as I contributed, but I carried with me, you know, that determination to get out to all corners of the country, you know, in inner cities, in rural areas, and hear people's perspectives. You know, Northern Ireland, I think, is unique in that it, you know, it underwent so much change in a fairly rapid period of time. And so it's a bit different, but elsewhere in the UK and in Ireland, it really struck me that the police hadn't lost the connection to the community. That the police in Ireland, for instance, I think they still have close to a 85-90% favorability rating when a survey is done, when an independent survey is done. Everybody in Ireland knows their local guard. You know, it's a relationship that's evolved over the years. And yeah, while they, like other police departments, have had their tragedies or they've had their scandals from time to time, you know, they've really been able to maintain that close relationship with the community. And I think here in the U.S., we envy that. And, you know, I've seen that similar relationship in many police services throughout the U.K. You know, I think that you've been true to the old Peelian principles that, you know, when Sir Robert Peel founded the Metropolitan Police, you know, and stated those powerful principles, you know, you remained true to them on your side of the Atlantic. And here in this country, I think we drifted apart. You know, we started fighting the war on crime back in the 60s and 70s, and it became pretty anonymous. We lost that connection to the community, and now we're working desperately over the last few decades to get it back. And it's difficult. You know, once you've lost it, it's difficult to recover it. I've always been envious of many of my friends in the UK and many of my friends in Ireland who have served in policing. And, you know, I think that's something to be very proud of, you know, that strong community connection.
I had the privilege of going over to Dallas in the late 90s, and a lot of officers were kind of in awe of, you know, being a UK Bobby, policing without a gun and all that kind of stuff. You realise just, you know, how we are viewed from other parts of the world, you know, and it's, but I am immensely proud.
Here in the US, we have universal respect and appreciation for the work you do there. And both in most of the UK and in Ireland, you're serving routinely unarmed. And that's incredible. I know when, again, I arrived in Ireland, the first question the media asked is, oh, you're from America. You know, we're sure you'll want to arm the police. When's that going to happen? And I said, no, on the contrary. I said, I'm incredibly envious that you know, that's something we've been unable to do in the U.S. I have huge respect for police who serve in an unarmed or routinely unarmed capacity. And in Ireland at the time, we were seeing an increase in, you know, some guns and violent crime and gangs. And I said, look, you know, I want to do whatever we can to enhance the safety of officers, get them better equipment, get them stab vests, get them pepper spray, get them some of the tools that will help protect them. We also created, at the inspectorate's suggestion, they established some armed response units that, you know, had weapons locked away, and those weapons could only be activated, you know, in an armed situation, an emergency situation. Sure. But, you know, still they perform their duties in a routinely unarmed capacity, and I have huge respect for that.
Again, it's something, you know, that we are really proud of, and I think sometimes you forget how we are viewed by other police officers around the world.
Yeah, with huge respect and envy. and you're right.
No, you know, really
we're
nice to hear.
We're very far away from that. I mean, I don't want to sound naive, or it's unrealistic at this point with all the guns in our society, sadly, that our police officers could go out and serve. But still, I mean, the vast majority of police officers in this country, you know, only a fraction of 1% ever discharge a weapon. You know, they have to have it on the occasion that they're being threatened or someone else is being threatened with deadly force.
One of the things I picked up on earlier, you were really keen to, you know, look at data and get the right data, you know, particularly when it was just a case of, you know, responding to 911s. And I just wonder from your point of view, how you think, you know, technology in the 21st century can play that role in helping more efficiently.
Well, I think that robust and timely data is invaluable, not just to police leaders, but to elected officials and to the community as well. Again, it gives the police an opportunity to tell the real story of policing. Again, I started my career back in a day where the detectives used to have a pin map, and they'd put a little pin in the map on, you know, where a crime had occurred. And of course, suddenly you'd see a pattern emerge, but the pattern had usually come and gone by the time the pins went up on the map. So now we have the advantage of technology, and we can capture information, valuable information, and we can process it, analyze it, and utilize it in a timely fashion. So I think in terms of prevention and intervention, it's invaluable to us. Crime is only a fraction, maybe 15% of what police do, and violent crime is only about 4% of what police do in this country. So we need to capture more data around what else the police are doing. You know, I also mentioned we started capturing data around people in mental health crisis, and that was invaluable to us to be able to show how much time and effort we put into responding to those vulnerable people, and also determining which ones were violent and which ones were armed and, you know, those that were threatening. So it gave our police and our community, you know, more valuable information to protect themselves, but also to assist those people. It all starts with a solid computer-aided dispatch system, a CAD system that captures timely and accurate information, and then a records management system that police officers enter their reports into. And I'm all for mobile systems. Police officers historically have spent far too much time in stations writing out reports or sitting behind clunky terminals with old technology, entering data into drop-down menus. You know, we need them out there in the field where they belong, visible, and entering data, entering their reports on tablets or on mobile phones. I'm a huge advocate for systems that are transparent. When I was in Seattle, for instance, we started public-facing data dashboards so that members of our community could go online and not only track what was happening in terms of crimes in their neighborhoods, but we had a dashboard on use of force so they could see how often police were using force, who the subjects were, where the subjects lived, what the demographics were of the people who were being subjected to force. If there were any patterns among, you know, certain officers assigned to certain stations. I mean, we were able to garner lots of information, but we put it right out there, gave it to the community to look at as well. You know, we put out all the statistics about our work with people in mental health crisis. Again, we anonymized the data, so we're not going to violate anybody's privacy. We're able to give the community, you know, a much better perspective on how the police are doing. That data was very flattering to the police. I mean, people assume that police are using force very regularly when in fact it's a fraction of 1% of encounters. People are sometimes shocked to see that, shocked and hopefully reassured. And if we did have some concerns or some anomalies, we would dig in further, we would look at it, we'd assess it, but we'd share it. Even if it's a bad news story, I think people really appreciate the fact that you're sharing the data. I think it helps to build trust and legitimacy. And if there's something troubling, if there's a troubling pattern that's emerging, whether it's a disparity or, you know, or there's concerns about bias, then you address it head on.
You're right, that transparency. And I can say this now, sometimes I think US chiefs are better at it than probably some of the UK chiefs. I just think sometimes we play that political game. And all the public want you to do is just to be honest and upfront, tackle it head on.
You're so right. And coincidentally, I just facilitated a panel at the International Association of Chiefs of Police Conference last week. It was held here in the U.S., so we had police chiefs from all over the world. But I was moderating this panel, and it was police chiefs who'd just been working in crisis situations, you know, really serious crisis situations. And the message across the board, and I was very heartened by it, was, you know, stand up, tell the truth, share as much information as possible. You know, of course, you can always say this is a situation that's unfolding, you know, the information may change, you know, put that warning out there. But at the same time, in my experience, you know, just tell the truth.
Definitely.
But even from a practical perspective, if you don't tell the story and you don't get the facts out there, the accurate facts out there, then somebody else will tell the story for you. So not only
absolutely,
you know, I'd like to think that we do it because it's the right thing to do. But you and I worked in policing at a time when police chief would often stand up and say, sorry, under investigation, we'll get back to you. It's a dynamic situation. We can't share any information at this time. People don't want to hear that. And I don't blame them.
That's what I'm saying. It kind of insults their intelligence, in my view.
I agree.
I've got the utmost respect for the current Met Commissioner, Sir Mark Rowley, is that he's turned around and said, you know, with a kind of, you know, a lower risk type mental health situation, what he was finding was that his total shifts were being wiped out with officers, you know, looking after mental health type patients. And what he's done is he's put more responsibility onto the mental health kind of practitioners and organisations and said, look, we'll still respond to obviously your more serious kind of issues, but my officers on certain risk were not going. Mm-hmm. I'm sort of in admiration for him to do that, because he's understood that if his officers are all stuck with those type of situations, his force is effectively ineffective at times. So I think that's a really bold move by him, to be honest with you.
Yeah, but I think it's a wise move too. In some of the jurisdictions I've worked in, and again, most recently Seattle, we've had teams of officers who've worked with mental health professionals to to respond to crisis situations. And we're now training the dispatchers to be more capable of determining where to send police versus where to send mental health professionals. And again, it's a delicate situation because you never want to put a social worker or mental health professional into a situation that could be potentially dangerous. Not only will it relieve the police of a lot of this responsibility so that they can focus, you know, on other issues that are demanding, but it'll provide better outcomes for the people involved.
He's got a tough job, but I do think he's going to turn things around in time if he's given the time. Hopefully he's going to come on at some point, so it'd be great to sort of speak to him about some of his decisions. One of the things I was doing when I was doing my research around you was a brilliant book that you wrote with Bob Pierce, The 7 Ways to Fix Policing. Fantastic book. I'd highly recommend it.
Yeah, well, thank you for that. So Bob Pierce is actually from the UK. He worked for the Foreign Service there. In fact, he was on Chris Patton's team in Hong Kong. And then Patton also brought him to Northern Ireland to serve as the secretary to the Patton Commission. So Bob and I have remained friends for years, and he's now married to an American woman and living in the United States. So that's,
right.
You know, your loss has been our gain. And Bob actually came with me a few years ago to the Republic of Ireland when we did an exercise similar to Patton. It was a commission on the future of policing in Ireland. And I feel like I've learned some of my best lessons about policing there. So it was an opportunity to co-author a book and take some of those lessons learned from earlier in our careers and apply them. You know, it's not a long academic treatise or anything. It's a practical guide. We feel there's some real practical solutions in there. I hope you've enjoyed it.
If you were to pick maybe one from the 7, which one would you pick?
Personally, you know, the ones around community and the ones around recruitment of a diverse candidate pool, those are are near and dear to my heart. But I think they're all equally important, not just to police leaders, but to police officers and to communities. I mean, again, we're hoping that some elected officials and people living in communities will actually read it. Again, it's an easy read. We just try to keep it simple, straightforward, but we think it hopefully gives people an accurate perspective on policing today.
It's called The 7 Ways to Fix Policing with Robert Pierce and Kathleen O'Toole. and it's widely available. I got mine off the Amazon Kindle store. It's a really, really good read, and I would highly recommend it.
You know, again, I don't claim to have all the answers, but you know, I have 4 decades of experience, and, you know, I'm one more voice at the table, and I feel that if I can share some of that experience and it's helpful to people, great, and still every day learn something new as well. So I really enjoy it.
Every day is a school day. You keep learning.
So true. It's so true.
Kathleen, we come to the end, really, more or less. Talked about quite a bit in the hour that we've had.
It's actually been a delightful discussion, and it just really struck me how much we do have in common. We've shared policing experiences on the opposite sides of the Atlantic, but it's remarkable how the principles are universal and how our experiences in many respects are similar. Well, hopefully we'll continue to cross paths.
I hope so. Thank you so much for coming on. That's so good to get a different perspective. But as you said, lots of similarities as well. But I just wanted to thank you personally for, you know, taking the time out from your busy schedule just to come on and share your views. I really do appreciate it.
Well, thank you for the invitation. It was really a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Community Safety Podcast. If you've enjoyed the episode, please subscribe, rate and review the podcast. We really appreciate your support, and we will catch you on the next episode.
Alongside support from St Ives Chambers, RHE Global and Barden Co Recruitment in partnership with District 4, you have been listening to the Community Safety Podcast with Jim Nixon.